Everything is terrible, everything is terrible, everything is terrible, everything is terrible.
But here's the thing.
Everybody, everyone, everywhere has a choice.
Be good humans.
Hey, little secret about being a good human,
okay,
Brian.
All right.
Kids are naturally born as good humans.
I agree.
No, I mean
100%. Nobody's born wanting to be. I grew up. I want to be an asshole.
No, that's not a thing. So every kid is just naturally defaults to good human status.
It's true.
Guarantee as a young kid, you were the best.
I think I was.
No, you were.
I was a good son.
Did you have fun as a kid?
I had a blast.
Yeah.
What
was your favorite thing to do? Talk to me about you playing. Like, what was your favorite thing to play?
What age now?
Oh, let's go from 5 to 10.
5 to 10. Play. All right. We had an old house.
Yep.
In Cambridge, Illinois.
Okay.
And because our house had the biggest porch, it was kind of a wraparound porch.
Yeah, yeah.
So our house,
kid central.
Mom wasn't crazy about this after a while, but that's where everybody met.
Yeah.
And we would do, you know, whether it's board games or we had a baseball field that we actually kind of stole our neighbor's yard with, and we play out in the rain and just muddy up their yard, ruin their grass and all that. But we played football and just all sports. Yeah. How about you? Now you. Obviously, we're from the same kind of area.
I grew up in Oklahoma, not Illinois, but very
small
similar small town vibe. And yeah, I mean, the thing that I remember about my youth, aside from just the sort of classic suburban model of you never wanted for playmates because the whole neighborhood was filled with kids, right? So that was always a thing. But what I also remember is that every neighborhood I ever lived in bordered woods. So you could just literally just go run wild in the woods.
Yeah.
Play army or hide and seek or, you know, whatever it was.
Well, speaking of army, this is a quick story. I was a kid. I loved my G.I. Joe. And this is when the G.I. Joes were like a foot tall. Or
The pull tab that would talk?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That
which I ended up obviously taking that apart.
Yes.
Just to see how it
would work. I would pull the tab and throw it up as high as I could. And then it would hit and go.
Try that.
Yeah.
But I would like make parachutes with my dad's hankies and all that. But one time I had this genius idea, and I still to this day think it's genius.
Yeah.
I was pretty young, so I didn't know what when a woman gets her monthly visitor.
Okay,
I didn't know what those were.
Sure,
those were. But those I did know that there was a big pink box in the bathroom closet, and I never knew what that was in there. So I looked one time, and the idea, a light bulb comes onto my head.
Yes.
These look just like sandbags. I could build a bunker for my G.I. Joe.
Oh, wow.
So
I'm sure your mom appreciated
I'm out
that.
In the front yard with about 30. I made a fort of these things, you know, with a machine gun and all that. And it looked so authentic.
I actually think Barbie would have been proud of you. There's something, there's a nice feminist slant to that.
My G.I. Joe would go over to my sister's room and beat the hell out of Ken on a daily
basis. Well, of course, as you would expect from G.I. Joe. Well, let me ask you this. Yeah. What about playgrounds?
Oh, lived for them.
Yeah, because we come from the same generation. So it's remarkable that you say you lived for them because it wasn't easy
ironic
to live.
Yeah.
What was your favorite playground equipment, first of all?
Jungle gym, I think. You're hanging from the jungle gym.
Which were just pure metal, lead pipes.
Yeah.
They were like lead bars.
Just like 1,000 degrees heated in the sun.
Yes, yes, yes.
You come home with birds on the back of your legs from hanging upside down.
Yes, yes.
And I like that. The slide, of course.
Oh my God, the slides of the 70s were like 90 degree angle slides.
Some of them rusty.
Yes.
And some of them rusted out. So
yes.
In them.
Yes, and usually a very abrupt drop into dirt. At
right.
the end. So that was a thing. And also, who could forget the brain scrambling merry-go-round on the 70s playground?
Which was always rusty as well.
Made from rebar, usually.
Yeah.
And very, 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 very loose.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get those things going at 600 revolutions a minute, and you would be vomiting, you would be dizzy, you would be literally ejected from the centrifugal force.
Yep.
And then get right back on the damn.
Do you remember the seesaw?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now, the seesaw was pretty boring. I mean, let's face it. And you kind of had to use it with somebody around your side.
Yeah,
otherwise,
correct.
It kind of didn't work. But do you remember the first time someone tricked you by on a seesaw?
Forget it.
I walk really fast.
Yes.
And you slam down and everything gets damaged.
And so I will tell you this. This is my worst horror story, my worst playground horror story, where I literally actually could have died in retrospect. So my parents would occasionally take us to a Howard Johnson's restaurant.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think that chain still exists.
Oh, we had one too, about 20 miles away. Yeah.
So this particular Howard Johnson's also had a Howard Johnson's motel and therefore had a playground right outside the restaurant. And you could see it through the windows of the restaurant. So as a kid, you'd be sitting there like, you would eat whatever you were told to eat.
Yeah.
Just, can I go? And the reason I wanted to go was because the centerpiece of this Howard Johnson's playground was a tall, I'm going to say 15 feet high, maybe, a tall rocket-shaped steel bar climbing structure.
Yeah.
That had a circular staircase to the top, and you would go up to the top of the rocket ship.
Oh, sure, sure.
And then there was a slide that came out, right? So
like this picture here?
Oh, my God, that's it. That's exactly it.
I Googled dangerous playground equipment, and this came up.
Yes, it was a three-level rocket. Now, what really struck my fancy was you could see from the restaurant that on top, on the exterior of this rocket climbing structure, was a red flashing siren bulb, right? So they had put a bulb up there to make it look, you know, extra cool, like it's a real spaceship or something. So all I wanted to do was get out there and get that spiral, get up the spiral stair, get to the top and, you know, see what the light would look like from inside of the top. So I couldn't wait. Finally, my parents let me go. I run out there by myself. I climb up the rusted staircase. I get up to the top level. I can't really see the light, but what I can see is the center steel pole that goes down through the core of the ship that is rusted, because again, that's a hallmark of all of the old playground equipment of our youth. It's not just rusted. It's rusted through in holes so that you can see the exposed electrical wiring that goes down the middle
of the light.
For the light. Now, I'm a kid. I'm like 7 years old. I don't know. So for some reason, like kids do, I reach in, grab a hold of these wires inside this metal pole, get the first, probably worst shock of my life, to the point where I can't let go of it.
Oh, so I
finally let go.
A long time? Because you didn't fall back right away.
You're a kid, it seems like an eternity.
Right.
Probably a tenth of a second. But like, I just let go, and I finally let go, and I just sobbed my way down the end of the slide. Mm-hmm. This was my most traumatic playground experience.
But you asked my favorite?
Yes.
My favorite?
Yes.
Was absolutely the most dangerous.
Okay, what was it?
Every Saturday night, Dad would load up the car with wife and kids, three kids, and he'd drive 15 miles to Kewaunee. Mm-hmm. From Cambridge to Kewaunee, where outside on the other side of Kewaunee was the Wani Drive-In.
Oh, okay.
And I've my first Elvis movie, my first John Wayne movie.
I
still have great memories of this. But people would get there when the sun's still out, you know, and you wait for it to get dark and the first film to start. Well, they had a playground underneath the screen.
Okay.
A big playground.
Right, because kids get bored at drive-in movies pretty quickly.
And parents get pretty sick of that.
Yeah.
So
and parents want to have a little private time.
But we could not wait to get out of that car once Dad parked up on the, you know, the hilly, the lumpy thing. And gets the speaker out and we just jumped out of the car. We ran because there was a ride there.
Okay.
And it was known as the Maypole.
Okay.
Where in my area, but it's also known as the Witch's Hat.
Okay.
I'm going to show you a picture of it.
Okay.
And this is it. Now, you can describe it.
Yes. Okay. So anybody who's listening right now, you can probably conjure this in your brain. You probably played on one, but you should Google it. It's kind of a maypole, yes, as described, but it's sort of a cone-shaped, triangular, almost sort of Christmas tree thing with a rotating hinge at the top so that the whole configuration will spin around.
Yeah. So think of a witch's hat only, but instead of cloth or material, it's chains.
Yes.
Okay. And there's this ring, actually two rings.
Yes.
Going around connected to the chains. And what you're supposed to do is you grab onto it and somebody gets on the other side and you're swinging back and forth. Now, if you want to grab onto the outside ring, otherwise, if you grab onto the inside ring and the thing slams into the metal base,
it will break. Slammed.
So many kids had hospital ambulances were coming in and out of there. What could possibly go wrong with this dangerous?
That's broken digits waiting to happen.
It was, but I could wait to get on it. See, how did we ever make it?
Right. I mean, that's the fact that we have managed to survive any of these torture devices.
Yeah.
Which were called playground equipment in our youth, is remarkable.
Now, let me ask you this thing. Now, you're a father. I'm not in this state.
Well, but you're no state. I mean, but you are 10 years old. So,
well, I am 10 years old.
Yeah,
am not.
Or two.
I'm not an affinity. But as a father, you have three incredible kids.
Yes, I mean, they're all grown. But
you, you and Nancy both had such a wonderful job. Not just saying that, they're fantastic.
That's nice.
Now, when they were kids, did you enjoy taking them to a park? And the reason I'm asking is because my mom couldn't wait for us to get out of the car so she could take off and go get her hair done or something.
Yeah, well, part of that's a different generation of parenting, right? My folks did the same thing. But yes, to answer your question, in part because thankfully the world's playground producers learned from their mistakes and all of those broken children from our youth.
Oh, cool.
And they recreated much safer versions of playground equipment for this generation.
And I'm happy to say it's been a while since I've been to a playground.
Yeah, that's fine.
If I had,
that would be a little weird.
Out at a That'd playground be, at my age.
Yeah, what's Uncle Brian doing there? Anyway, that's a little creepy. But yes, they have improved a lot of those things. But
good.
B, yes, to answer your question, there are few greater joys in this life.
Hmm.
As a parent, then going and sitting and not just watching your kids play, because you can do that at home. It's more about watching your kids play with other kids who they don't know, navigating that part of life, right? Watching them sort of get to know kids on the fly. And is this my friend? Is this it? You know, and
is there one that comes to mind one time that was most special for you?
Oh, without question, because this was a situation where I not only got to watch my kids play, but quite unexpectedly, it became one of the most beautifully profound experiences I've ever had.
Mm.
Taking my firstborn child when she was a toddler, Clementine, was about 4 years old, 3 or 4 years old. We heard about a new playground opening in Los Angeles. Didn't really know anything about it other than here, this place is supposed to be great.
Okay.
But rather than me tell you about this, we should talk to the people who are responsible for this. So we are pleased and proud and privileged to welcome to the show Scott Williams and Catherine Curry Williams, who had a very direct hand in, without me even knowing it at the time, curating this experience for me and my kid, even though it wasn't really for me and my kid. So first of all, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us. We're honored.
It is lovely to have both of you. To the extent that you were able and willing to do so, would you mind, and I recognize as a parent, but also as a human being, what we are asking of you here, but would you take us back to 1997 and how this extraordinary journey began?
Well, we were married a year, and Scott and I were just so excited. I was pregnant with he looked more pregnant, so
I see.
He'd all conclude that I couldn't.
I was eating for three, so
nice.
Exactly.
You know, so excited. We had at the time I had all the physical tests that were taken, and we were all good and had a great pregnancy. Scott was painting the room six colors to Sunday, and we were gonna have a boy.
Aww.
We found we're gonna have a boy, and we were just beyond excited with ourselves because no one in the family, this was going to be the first boy.
Oh, wow.
Scott has a sister who has two daughters. I have three sisters that have four daughters.
Oh my God. The estrogen runs strong in these.
Oh, I was so happy to be adding a boy to this.
Of course.
Really,
yeah. And I'm one of, all my four sisters. So we were like a boy. Oh my. Oh. So this was 1997 and March 28th. That was the day that I was ready to give birth, and everything was fine and normal, and excitement was in the air. And then when we delivered Shane, he was it was very quiet, and he didn't take his first breath. And they you know what they call it, they rushed him to the NICU. They came in very quickly. Scott and I went from elation and joy to
fear and
paralysis. We were stunned.
Speechless. We're first of all, I wasn't in a position literally to do anything. They're just leave with my baby, and I'm just like when Scott went after him, because really we had no idea, because he was born full term. He looked beautiful. Everything looked in order, and as it turned out, he was paralyzed, and we didn't know anything. He could only open his eyes.
Yeah, listen, we were, as Catherine said, so prepared for, you know, the greatest day of our lives. And then our doctor was just as shocked when he failed to take a breath. And he hits a button on the wall and the crash cart comes down from the NICU and a team of nurses and doctors sweep him away. And I'm torn between my wife, who's still on the table, and I not knowing what to do. But I never saw this look over my doctor's face, this look of panic when he couldn't get Shane to draw his first breath. And he was essentially paralyzed from about mid-face down. At any rate, the sad diagnosis came. One of the things they said to us, they said, listen, at the very best case scenario is your son will probably be spending his life in a wheelchair. Well, we had a guardian angel who had been part of the hospital who allowed us to stay. We got to stay in her initial and Catherine's initial room in the maternity ward so that we could go down and just sit with Shane and be there. And it was interesting because he was a full 7-pound baby and he had all these preemies all around him and incubators because it was the NICU.
Gosh, geez.
But it was a really rough, obviously, as you can imagine, time. And one of the things we in our minds were sort of preparing to do was raise a child with a disability. It was a scary thing for me because I'd been raised in Yonkers, New York by really nice parents who, you know, sent money to Jerry's Kids every Labor Day weekend.
Sure.
But our attitudes around disability, especially with children, were, oh, it's just too sad. It's too awkward. It's just don't step over there. So
it happens to other people is kind of the way.
Yeah, it happens to other people, not us. So suddenly it was happening to us. And I was a little ashamed of my reaction to it, but I quickly embraced. And, you know, my sister who had come in from New York just said, just take photos, like be there for him. You know, he needs
amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So Catherine and I, it was about a week in when they said they identified spinal muscular atrophy.
So we knew nothing until day 10, except we're going to take him home. He's going to be in a wheelchair. Scott's little nieces were like, we're going to have ramps. And, you know,
it was a pretty incredible moment because my niece Dorothy, who I think was about 7 at the time, my sister broke the news like, okay, Shane is here, but it looks like he's going to spend his life in a wheelchair. And Dorothy at 7 just went, what's the big deal? We'll just build ramps every
day. Aww,
that's how she gets
from the mouth of babes. We didn't realize that sort of it was going to end up being our mission, help provide part of our mission was those simple words. But when they let us know there was kind of no hope, we sort of we kept Shane for about, what was it, honey, about 5 days, where we exhausted every possibility.
We didn't know what it was. But and once course. We should get it was,
yeah,
we worst tried, case but... scenario was that he would not live. And
Shane gave us a look. The light kind of had gone out in his eyes, and we realized that, you know, they said the only thing you can do is take him off the vent. So they gave us a room, and we got to play some soft music, and it was, you know, the saddest, sweetest thing we ever saw. We took him off.
Yeah. To stay with that for a moment, because we have no choice. Like, I, as a parent, as a human being, I'm so sorry that you had to experience anything like that, that anyone ever has to experience anything like that. Can't imagine. Because having been there 3 times myself, yes, you're filled with joy. You're also filled with exhaustion. And then to have that then quickly superseded by fear and horror and uncertainty. And then
smack dab into certainty. This is, we're going to have ramps. We're going to do this. And you embrace that, you know, until Shane finally succumbed. And people deal with grief and grieving in different ways. And this is where it gets incredibly special. And you decided to do something in his memory.
If you don't mind, Heather, let me talk, because I'm gonna talk about you. Because honestly, it was obviously the darkest day. We had a huge contingent of friends and community and family that were just wanting to do, what can they do? What can we do? And obviously you lose a child, there's nothing you can do. And so I had just gotten my first TV writing job after that. Oddly enough, though, you'll find this kind of, as we were considering raising a child with a disability, I was, you know, I had a career where I was writing, you know, I was 4 years removed from bartending and writing movies that nobody was making.
I know as well.
Have to retrofit your house with ramps and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I said to my sister and my friends who would come in, I said, you know, I have to figure out a way to kick my career into overdrive in order to pay for his medical care. And it was the next day, my agent called me and said, Scott, don't ask me how, but that script that you wrote for Ray Liotta that never got made, like, David Milch wants to meet with you. So, like, it showed up, and I said, is that a good thing? He goes, it's a really good thing, but I'll just tell them what you're going through, and I'll put it off. So it was about a month after Shane died that I went and took the meeting and started working. But the hard part of that was I was leaving Catherine home to grieve alone on the couch.
Of course.
And also we had also tried to, you know, heal ourselves by having another baby. And Catherine had suffered two miscarriages that year after that. So it was like, it was a very difficult,
very dark days, like you
said. Very dark days. But again, I have to say, like, you know, I married an incredibly strong, tough woman that, and also lots of people came to us were like, my God, this would like break up so many couples.
True.
Be so terrible. And you know, it never even entered our mind because if anything, it brought us closer together. And we felt like it would be a disservice to Shane to go that way. There was no blame between us. There was nothing to blame. And
of course.
But really, I just followed Catherine's lead because she's so gracious herself in her grief. And then about a year later, my sister sent an article about a woman in Connecticut who also had a son with SMA. It was like, hey, look at this. We'd never heard of SMA. Look at this.
Here it is.
But the woman had built a playground in memory of her son. And I read the article going, wow, SMA, small world. Catherine read the article and said, we're building a playground.
That's really?
We're doing this. Yeah. Wow. She didn't even blink. Because, you know, I think I was.
Well, it was the first thing that really got me out of my depression is to think that I can do something good in his memory. Until I saw Amy Barzek is her name, and I called her when I saw the article, and I, you know, we became friends at that moment. Her son was 9 months old, and you know, it's something good in his memory, because I could, you know, I don't want to take credit for thinking of anything good. I was writing like hate mail to God, And I was from Shane's beautiful bedroom that Scott had painted over and over. So I wasn't feeling very altruistic or going to do something good. And then I really feel like that gift that his sister sent me, you know, that changed everything for me.
No question. I mean, this is a situation where grief, frankly, can freeze people. This suddenly presents itself almost as an opportunity or a way, some way,
yeah,
try and turn grief into action.
All these years later, I see how it gave me my life. That, you know, I
sure
like, and they always say, I, you know, we've heard and we know this to be true that, you know, when you're complaining most, do something good for someone else.
So, Kat, without missing a beat, you say we're going to build a playground.
We are going to build a playground, and it's not just going to be a regular playground. So let's go look at all the playgrounds that are accessible in our town. And of course, research. I had plenty of time now. Scott was back at work, and I called all around to find playgrounds with that had accessibility to them. And not one was playable. Not one was playable for a child in his wheelchair or her wheelchair.
The Americans with Disabilities Act did a great thing where it's like, that's why we have street corner ramps and we have the big bathroom stalls, all that stuff. And in the area of playgrounds, every playground we saw that would call itself wheelchair accessible had a cement ramp leading to a sand moat with wood chips inside, play equipment inside that a kid in a wheelchair couldn't reach.
Yeah.
And then doing more research, I found out only 10% of kids could actually leave their wheelchairs. And then more research to find out parents weren't going to accessible playgrounds because it was a big disappointment to them. You know,
all their kids can do is literally watch other kids play.
I spent the next 3 months researching and crying about what a state of our playgrounds were in California. And then at some point, councilman at the time, Michael Fuhr, we reached out to him and he was like, what? I just read what you said, because we had created a plan and
what we were planning to
do by this point. And he was like, what? I want to see what they're talking about.
This is an opportunity.
Statistics there.
In thanking him for his involvement early on, he said, Scott, are you kidding me? These are the projects you go into politics to do.
This is
tailor-made for making LA better.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and so it moved on to, let's see if we can get you some land to build the playground. And we said, we'll raise the money. However, we will. We had some kind of party that we told people what we thought we were going to do.
Well, we had in our favor, I mentioned those people earlier, like when they all want to help you, but when you lose a child, there's nothing you can do. When you tell those same people you're going to build a playground in your son's memory, they really show up.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And also what we were proposing was so non-controversial.
How are you going to argue against this?
Yeah. Although it's funny, when we did pitch city council, you know, there were a few, you know, old school guys who were like really great, but like they had the old sensibility, like kind of my parents had, where it was like, how are you going to keep the able-bodied kids from beating up the disabled? Right. You know, they had these ideas.
Yeah, they weren't really great. They were.
It was a harder ball to roll uphill than you would imagine. I was like, this is a no-brainer, right? And they come back like, you won't believe it. Some people actually had issues with it.
Well, these are some antiquated and frankly just uninformed notions of what kids need. And by that, I don't mean just disabled kids, but like all kids, really.
And the greatest joy from it is that we weren't building a playground at this point when all the wheels started going in motion, and Griffith Park donated 2 acres of land to us, which then we raised $1 million and we donated it back to the park. So we learned everything on the job, literally. Yeah.
An extraordinary amount of information you had to take on very, very quickly. And also, they had to really make the first choice of like, we're going to do something with this grief. But then it seems to me, hearing your story, there were a number of other places where you had to make a choice when things, as you put it, Kat, you would find yourself crying in Shane's room, just feeling overwhelmed by all of the different things that felt kind of stacked against you. You kept having to make a series of progressive choices about, we're going to keep going with this? Because a lot of people would have easily walked away and understandably walked away from this kind of a monumental effort. You carry it through.
Guys, honestly, you're talking to a woman here that does, you know, she does not take no for an answer.
It's a shame that the two of you don't think more highly of each other.
You kind of get that right away with meeting both of you.
We're fans. It's a mutual fan club. Because I'm the more cynical, where I was like, I'm a New Yorker. We're both New Yorkers, but I'm a cynical New Yorker. I was like, I don't know, people going to let you down. Are they going to show up? Are they going to do this? They're going to say, okay, well, I guess no hope. And she's like, no, we are not taking no for an answer. If I can't get a yes from this person, I'm going to get a yes from that person. And also, I want to also mention something that Catherine did, which I thought was pure genius, was playground companies that make playground equipment didn't have adequate equipment for kids with disabilities. So Catherine came up with the idea of what she called a dreaming and design party, where we got together through Cedars-Sinai Hospital. She reached out to and she had a party for kids with disabilities to, like, with crayons draw, what's your dream? What would you like to do at a playground? What is it you'd like to see? What would you like to? And they're drawing swings where there are wheelchairs on the swing.
Of course.
That is incredible. What a great idea.
And I was like, wait, you're going to let the actual kids design this? She goes, well, let's see what their dream, what they really, really miss doing. And a lot of it was swinging. A lot of it was that feeling. A lot of them miss the feeling that we all grew up with, where we spun on that godforsaken metal thing that you jumped off of and threw up.
Yeah.
Why should a kid with a disability be spared that? You know,
sure.
No, they were drawing things that they saw able-bodied kids do, and to their credit, we worked with the playground companies, who then were able to kind of come up with versions of what they were drawing.
And then
they use it to this day. So
let's go back to the opening of the first of Shane's inspiration, as you said, in Griffith Park. This is where your story becomes not just my story, but the story of multitudes of parents and their kids.
Yeah.
But we heard about this place opening. We took our daughter just thinking, oh, there's a new playground opening.
Right.
To sit there as a parent and watch my 3 or 4 year old daughter run around playing gleefully with disabled kids. And of course, kids don't see any of those disabilities anyway. She just saw playmates. But they were able to be her playmates by virtue of the way this place had been so imaginatively and lovingly and carefully, thoughtfully designed. Yeah. I sat there for hours with a gigantic lump in my throat. I was far from the only one experiencing that. So that's what it was like just for dumb old me. What was it like for you to sit there after all of the anguish, all the tears, all of the effort, all of the wrangling and the city council and all of that, like to finally accomplish that? What was it like for you to sit and watch kids thoroughly enjoy themselves?
You want to go, honey? You want me to go?
I was going to say both of us probably were. I know we were just speechless and in tears, but the greatest joy in that first opening one is our daughter was 9. We had a healthy baby girl name, and her name is Grace. She's 24 now. Mm-hmm. And she was there at the opening because it's another 2 years to build that playground.
You know, as you put so eloquently about, you know, your kid playing with a disabled kid, you know, we wanted to make sure that people didn't think this was a special park or this is a park for disabled kids.
Right.
That's why we call it inclusive, where no one's left out, because we wanted, as much as it was for kids with disabilities to be able to actually play, but for the non-disabled community, actually be able to experience socialization with the disabled community so that these biases could be lifted for that next generation. So that I wasn't, you know, the parents that made me, we could not have to repeat that to our kid.
Of course.
And thankfully, Grace is very facile. And I think a generation of kids have more exposure to,
yes,
socialization with kids with disabilities. I will tell one story that kind of surprised us. Was there was an old man at our at one of our opening days, and he was in a wheelchair and he was with his grandkids. And I asked him, we were thinking so much about kids, I forgot about adults.
Right.
And I asked him, I said, this is, you know, I told him who I was. And he says, let me tell you something. He says, I was paralyzed in a car accident when I was 17. He said, I could not take my kids to the playground because I couldn't get around at them. And thanks to this playground, I can now take my grandkids. So thank you. So it was this crazy thing that we had never thought of, where it was, you know, for disabled vets. There were other varying degrees of disability, like autism or Down syndrome, where there was actually play equipment that could speak to some of them. Catherine remembers it differently, because I always say, maybe it was just me, but I thought we were done with one playground.
Right.
You forgot who you married.
Yeah, pretty much.
Let's talk about that. A beautiful opening, a wonderful, it's working, everybody's loving it, it's doing what it's supposed to do. What was the next step for going from there to now 80 playgrounds?
Yes, because you could have been done. Again, here's another choice to make.
Right.
25 years later, there's 80 of these things around the world, and we haven't even gotten to Inclusion Matters. So
it was simple. There was a boy named Aiden who lived in Westwood, and going all the way to Griffith Park was more than a trek for he and his family with his oxygen and so on. He was probably about 4 years old at the time, and he was tiny, but he was this lovely, you know, soul. He wanted to see about having a playground in his neighborhood so he could get to it easy. So it was a genuine divine right action that went right to the next playground. So then, okay, it'll be two. And then the city said, well, we'll give you the land at this park by Sepulveda. It's a beautiful park over there. And you guys do your thing, because now they trusted what we can do. So that and this family, Aiden's family, had a whole new group of friends, and we raised money with them.
We often joke that, because they said, like, well, you know, how can we get one in our neighborhood? And they'll be like, well, we've already tapped out our friends for donations, but they'll
get your friends. Yeah.
Well, I must say our friends are, you know, 25 years still giving. They show up every time. And then there was a little girl in San Diego, Manhattan Beach? She was in another direction that was far. And so the kids were waiting to play, and Scott and I, you know, we were like, they're waiting to play, and we got a full-fledged, you know, nonprofit. We no longer had a fiscal sponsor, and, you know, we didn't want people to have to reinvent a wheel that took, you know, in probably the 2.5 years, I learned 20 years of
what
typically people are in Park and Recs, and then the Park and Recs department started asking us, what can we do? And then we, you know, showed them, and then they were like, well, can you put one in each one of our districts?
Right, of course.
We'll give you the land and we will donate a portion of funds, so you don't have to raise it all. And they all don't have to be, they all didn't have to be 2 acres, and they didn't have dollars. And
also, from the jump, we were like, well, we're not McDonald's. They don't have to all be called Shane's Inspiration. That'll be the name of the organization. But Aiden, the boy in Westwood, that became Aiden's Place. So everything that was started by a local community generally was spurred by some kid that, you know, family that had a need for their kid to play. And so we were able to just help these communities. We like to say it was an idea that's time had come, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's look at the future. Are there more playgrounds coming?
Yes. So after about 50, 60 playgrounds, the Shane's Inspiration organization as a whole decided to expand the name to put the mission before it. So now it is known as Inclusion Matters by Shane's Inspiration. I know it's a long name, and
you can call it whatever you want, my friend.
So it was a machine by this time that was so, it was moving on its own and moving well, and to not complicate things, I stepped aside, and then I started a new organization about 3 years ago called She Angels Foundation, and now I have about 150 women that are members, and we have what's called Giving Circle. And so each month they're members, so I don't have to do fundraisers, and I've learned so much that I've recreated a different organization to give to women and girls charities. So we give a $5,000 grant a month for the last 3 years. So I took the skills that I learned from Shane's in my life and pivoted, because the playgrounds are in action and they're going
to complete on the playgrounds, though, with your question of the projects, because Catherine wasn't done giving to the world, but noted, recognized too, that the organization had taken on a life of its own, didn't need her help anymore.
They do 50 jobs to Sunday. I have to say the one thing about grassroots organization,
very small overhead.
But they work, everybody does five jobs. Everybody was so brilliant that
well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, well beyond playgrounds now, Inclusion Matters is serving over 55,000 children through a school-based education program you guys have put in place. That it's like 67 countries.
We want to give a shout out to Tiffany Harris, who was, you know, she started as the co-founder and a friend, but she became she's the COO or the director of Tiffany.
The grand poobah.
The grand poobah. Exactly. I say I'm the chief bottle washing cook. That's my, you know, oh, it's so fancy. I'm doing that. And I'm like, I'm washing the dishes, painting the walls.
Right.
What you have to do. It's grit. But Tiffany, I felt like the mission of the playgrounds and so on, it grew so much for me, had been complete. And there was so much more in the way of education. Mm-hmm. And Tiffany and her team, you know, and Scott, you can talk about it as well to see what they're.
Well, you know, just what we by the good graces of our expanding, you know, little galaxy, the Clinton Global Initiative got caught wind of us and said, hey, how can we help you guys go international? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, you know, the president of Ecuador was paralyzed in a robbery.
Right.
As a kid, and he was like, I want two of these at least in my district. And, you know, so we built them in Ecuador. We've been able to go around the world and expand in that fashion, which, you know, is far exceeds Catherine and my wildest.
Of course.
She, I shouldn't say that. My wildest dreams. Catherine dreams big. So I'm sure.
Yeah, she's not finished.
But every year we, Scott MCs and finds another grand poobah to do. We do a 10K for Shane's Inspiration and either a gal. Well, it's always been a gala, but this year they're going to do something different. So Scott always MCs, and, you know, we always rally our friends, and at least twice a year we are there bringing in everything it needs to continue as an organization to move forward, more friends and celebrities and people, because people still don't know completely, but we have changed the face of it. There's more needed. There's kids somewhere that are still needing place to play. Sure.
We have people come up to us and say things like, you know, for lack of a better, they'll call us heroes. Thank you. You don't know what you've done. This has helped me son so much. And honestly, from the earliest days, Catherine and I were like, no, we watching parents of kids with disabilities with this full-time job of this extra care that so many of us with able-bodied kids take for granted.
Right.
Watching. So we would say, no, like, you're the hero watching you parent this kid. Catherine and I had a sad void to fill. Like, you know what? And it was super cathartic for us to find this project, to be able to do something that bears his name and that we can go and visit and feel his spirit whenever we go. So it's never not been, we always like to say we get far more out of it than we've ever put into it.
No, this is simply extraordinary. You saw two needs. First and foremost, your own needs as parents to try and deal with an overwhelming amount of grief that anyone would experience. But then you identified a broader need of children, like Shane, of parents, families, communities, and through a frankly extraordinary effort. Catherine, I think the way you put it is you've sort of changed the face of things. It's so much more profound than that. You are literally not just the epitome of good parents, but you are, for purposes of our conversation, next level examples of what we talk about when we talk about good humans. People who have, we all have traumatic experiences in our lives. We all deal with tragedy. We all deal with challenges, but everyone has choices when they have those experiences to make. And the effort that you can put into trying to deal with your own loss by choosing instead to put love into the world in some form or fashion, in your case, by creating an inclusive playground for disabled children that then snowballed into 80 of those around the world and this extraordinary organization that is educating people and changing people's lives is just nothing short of angelic. So thank you for all of that.
Wow. I don't know what to say about that. It's,
thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for saying all that. I'll again just repeat that. Had I married any other woman, I might not have been in this place. She was the driving force behind all of it and remains so. And, you know, and again, once her mission was complete there for her to take on, to create She Angels now to help, you know, female founded nonprofits, it's I just always marvel at her tenacity and her willingness not to go quietly into the dark night. She's never not trying to improve life for someone. And I'm just, you know, I'm just lucky.
And a slice of pizza and it's a day.
Yeah, damn right. Bring it around. Where can people go? Because I'm loving looking at these pictures. Where can people go to find out more?
Where would you lead them? How can they be helpful?
Well, immediately visit the website at inclusionmatters.org to research that, because there's all kinds of opportunities. We have friends there. Our friend Marcy, man, she's a pit bull, man. She gets her teeth in, she won't let you go. It's like, if you give nuts, like, if you're looking for ways, if you're looking for ways to give and to help, they'll find ways for you to give and help, whether it's fantastic. A matter of connecting us to someone that maybe needs one of these playgrounds, or looking for ways to volunteer, or whether it's financial. We always say it's like not everything is about money. A lot of it's about effort, you know, and
of course.
So anybody that wants to help can go start
it's
off.
It's a huge resource. And once, is it the play date still happens? There's it's called My Play Club. You might see that as well. So they can make friends. So really going to the website.
They need volunteers more than twice a year because of those. Those are the two big fundraising events. But
okay.
We have lots of events at all of our different parks. And then again, the educational programs, really what they're meant to do is to teach kindness and inclusion in schools. Mm. And they're you know, it's a remarkable thing. It's something we hadn't conceived, but it kind of it was a natural extension from the playgrounds. We didn't want to just be about building parks. We wanted to be about teaching the next generation why inclusion is so important.
So inclusionmatters.org, Scott Williams, Catherine Curry Williams, thank you for what each of you have done individually. Thank you for what you've done as a couple. Thank you for what you've done for disabled kids, their parents, for the families and parents of abled kids, kids across the world.
And thank you for making guys like me, who I think I'm a pretty nice, pretty good guy. I do good things for people. Try to always. Thanks for making me feel really guilty.
Exactly. This
all right, wait, I'll give you something to do. Just give me a call. I'll.
Yeah, sure. Don't worry.
With the slice of pizza, that'll go first.
Deal.
I'm gonna woo you.
Well, thank you more than anything for being good humans and for giving us your time today.
We're honored. Thank you so much.
Thank you for bringing it to everyone's attention. We really appreciate it.
Our honor. All right. You asked me the first show, why are you here?
Yes.
That's why you're here. Those sentiments that you just shared, obviously you touched Scott and Kat. I was just kind of sitting there. I became not a host. I just became a listener. Like,
well, listen,
so eloquent, so lovely.
That's sweet. Much like my writing, 30 seconds after I do something or say something, I've completely forgotten it. But the point is, they made it easy.
Gorgeous.
I mean, how amazing are those people?
Yeah. Like, what am I doing? Let's get out and do something like that. That's incredible.
100% to process that kind of tragedy is just, it's so inspiring.
Process and
act on
make
it.
Something good
out of
horrible.
It's so true. So thank you for coming along on yet another journey with us in that department. And we look very forward to the next. So please join us for that. And in the meantime, I'm going to toss it back to you, my friend, because you're the one that started this.
Okay.
So what should our friends listening do?
Well, they should be good humans. Now, do you want that in Russian as well? Be good human ski.
I'm sorry.